Emerald Podcast Series. Research that makes a difference.
Welcome to the Emerald Publishing Podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Ridge, a commissioning editor at Emerald Publishing. Today, we're diving into the critical subject of trans and non-binary athletes' resistance in the world of sports. Our discussion is inspired by the book, Trans Athletes' Resistance, The Struggle for Justice in Sport. This edited collection meticulously documents and analyzes the formidable hurdles and resistance faced by trans and non-binary athletes. It explores how trans and non-binary athletes not only resist transphobic policies and practices, but also create new models of inclusive sport. Through sociological investigations and compelling firsthand accounts, the authors challenge binary definitions set by policymakers, the dominance of the achievement model, and the toxic masculinity common in many sports subcultures. Joining me today are the two co-editors of this volume. First, we have Ali Durham-Gray, a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto. Ali's research focuses on the experience of trans and non-binary individuals in sport and education. They are a SSHRC Joseph Armand Bombardier Scholar and a retired member of the Canadian Olympic boxing team. Our second guest is Helen Jefferson-Lenski, Professor Emerita at the University of Toronto. Helen has been a pioneering researcher and activist on gender and sports issues since the 1980s. She has published numerous books, including The Olympic Games, A Critical Approach, published by Emerald in 2020. Both Ali and Helen previously co-edited the 2022 publication, Justice for Trans Athletes, Challenges and Struggles. Today, we'll explore the groundbreaking work documented in Trans Athletes' Resistance, The Struggle for Justice in Sport, and discuss its implications for creating more inclusive and equitable policies in the world of sports. Great to have you both with us today. So the book that we're focusing on today is Trans Athletes' Resistance, which grew out of your first book, Justice for Trans Athletes. So before we delve into the Trans Resistance book, can you tell us first about for Justice for Trans Athletes and where that project took you?
Yeah, well, I can start with a short history, and that is that Ali and I were talking to one another many years ago, maybe five or six by now, about the possibility of Ali sending a book proposal for my Emerald book series on sport and gender. And that didn't happen for a variety of reasons. But the next time I contacted Ali was to ask, would she be interested in co-editing a book on trans athletes? And what triggered my sudden email to Ali was that there was sort of this buildup of such vitriolic comments on social media in the US and UK in particular, and this onslaught of trans exclusionary legislation in US states, which has probably tripled since I first started watching those stats. And so then we put out a call for proposals and got excellent response, to the extent that we thought two books were in order, the first one on the problems and the second one on the resistance and the solutions. So Ali, I'll let you fill in what I haven't said, which is quite a lot.
For me, having this chance to not just work with Helen, but to make two books with Helen was, you know, something you can only really dream about as a junior graduate student. I was going into my PhD, and I already had this chance to learn about what it's like to, how do you make a book proposal? How do you give feedback to tenured full professors? That's not something I learned as a graduate student, right? That's not something you really learn. Further to that, Helen's also an amazing writer. Like, if you read her work, it's smooth and buttery. And most of what I've been reading in sociology and sports sociology was not, like, it was not written for the reader. It was not thinking about finesse and grace and pleasure in reading. And so while on the one hand I got this incredible opportunity for my CV and my academic progression and competitiveness, Helen also gave me this opportunity to really model my writing after hers in that, developing my relationship with the reader became a priority.
Yeah, that sounds like a really great experience, really unique for, as you said, like an early PhD student. Most of the chapters in your collected book, The Trans Athlete's Resistance, use insights by an autoethnographical approach. So can you tell us about autoethnography and perhaps why it's so useful in discussing trans and non-binary experiences in sports?
Yes, I can start responding to that question, and just to sort of hark back to when I was an undergrad. And the rule almost in sociology was you do not insert the personal pronoun I or me or my, you write in the third person. And that, of course, was very restrictive and silenced particularly women, and then silenced LGBTQ people, silenced racialized people and so on, people with disabilities. All of us wanted to write from our own experience. And so the kind of rules in sociology, thank goodness, changed over the decades since I was an undergrad in the 1972 on. And so now autoethnography is encouraged, and it's an invaluable method of telling your story, telling your experience as a minoritized person, no matter what your identity is. So it was particularly useful for the many of the contributors to our second book. And I'll let Ali talk about some of the details of that, including Ali's own chapter.
We have two chapters on boxing. One is on my experience of boxing for Canada. And we have another one by Dan Irving. It's one of my favorite chapters in both books. And it's his experience of boxing. And he weaves in thinking about justice as a relational practice linked to his boxing and his exploration of gender through boxing. So I'm a big fan of that chapter. And when I teach courses on sport and gender, that's one of the ones I teach.
Yeah, that's great. So diving into your chapter a little bit, I was really enthralled by your chapter in which you describe your experience with boxing that we were just talking about. And you write that sports allows players to tell stories about themselves to themselves. In your experience, how does sports help athletes, particularly trans and non-binary athletes, understand themselves and make sense of who they are?
So stories, I mean, just like Helen mentioned, stories are data. Our experience is data. And that's what is so radical about autoethnography, is it helped me think about my experiences, what I was observing, what I noticed, how I felt within a broader political environment, right? And what's, I think, so transformative about autoethnography is that it has the potential for precision in a way that studies that take a more zoomed out look at macro samples do not have, the nitty gritty. And I wonder if that's what you found enthralling, is like just the precision. I mean, not of writing, I'm still working on that, but just of that experience. I don't know. I also find it really engaging to think about autoethnography in terms of teaching, because once people really connect with the idea that like the university actually finds their experience valid, it's information, it's knowledge, it's being produced. So yeah, it's autoethnography is just about stories.
Well, so how do you think that sports help athletes understand themselves and make sense of who they are?
So just a sense of oneself and a sense of one's potential strength, which was something in terms of my physicality, I did not have that knowledge, that self-knowledge, until I started doing Hapkido, which is a Korean system of self-defense. There is sparring involved, but it's primarily self-defense. And for me, at 5'2" or 5'3", to be able, you know, with a cooperative male partner doing the techniques, having the technique and having a slight advantage of a lower center of gravity, being only 5'3", to throw the guy onto the mat was just incredibly empowering and surprising as well. So I wrote a bit about that because in the conclusion, I think it was to book two, partly because I thought the reader might have a problem if they've never done a combat sport of any kind, or perhaps never a contact sport, which would be sort of on the road to this kind of understanding of physicality and power. But I thought a lot of readers may not have that experience personally and might need persuading that boxing isn't just this nasty, bloody sport, literally bloody, which both Dan Irving and Ali talk about in their chapters. So I just put a bit about my own experience with Hapkido and the empowerment that comes with that kind of experience. Another example, I think it was an Australian woman who took up boxing and then became a boxing coach and ran programs specifically for women who had been victims of domestic violence or sexual assault, and to then find that empowering, that empowerment through a physical sport like boxing or wrestling or contact sports to some extent. And I know way back when people were talking, sports sociologists were talking about what is it that's good for girls in sport. And I think somebody said, you learn to fall down and pick yourself up again. And women and girls in the 70s and 80s in particular were socialized to think that that simply wasn't possible, that you kind of, you got hurt, you lay there waiting for help kind of thing. I'm exaggerating, but, you know, that's a far cry from pick yourself up off the mat after you've been thrown in a martial arts move. And instead of being on the defensive, grab the other person and throw them onto the mat. So that kind of feeling, a real gut feeling of empowerment.
Yeah, well, so that brings me back to Ali's chapter on boxing. I'm wondering how, you know, Ali, you competed against both men and women, and I was wondering how that played a role in your own gender expression.
I can tell you about what it's like to spar with men, but I only competed against women. I was in the women's category. I'm biologically female. So I was just really only competing with women. But the thing is, at least when I was boxing, there were so few athletes in the women's division that we did most of our sparring in preparation with men and boys too, right? It's actually quite challenging to prepare for a fight, you know, sparring with guys and then get into the ring and then fight another woman. And that sort of speaks, I think, to Helen's point on socializing around gender, because yeah, it's super empowering to beat up a guy.
So how did that affect your life outside of the ring though? You know, you have that experience of sparring with a male, and then you walk out on the street, and how does that affect your own self-perception and how you embody yourself in the world?
It definitely made me feel more confident. I think I hadn't really spent a lot of time moving through the world thinking that I belonged in terms of taking up space. You know, and this was like the 2000s, the aughts. So for the first time, I didn't feel like I was in the way, and it was really empowering.
That's really cool. Well, I'm going to quote you to yourself, so I want to get your reaction to this. So in your chapter, you write, Ali, to deny trans people the ability to participate in competitive sport not only excludes us from the full participation in the public sphere, but this denial also diminishes our collective imagination of the vast possibilities of diverse gendered embodiment. So how do sports become a microcosm for the trans experience? And what does resistance really look like?
Trans is like a very both like umbrella concept for folks who don't feel like they fit in the normative categories of man and woman. So in that sense, I really do identify as trans. And also, you know, trans is a very specific identity that, you know, people who have had medical interventions or, you know, changed in documentation and beyond, like, that folks sort of really reserve for their experience. So when you were reading the quotation, I was really reflecting on how it's both like an act of allyship and solidarity to say our, like, because, you know, I think for most people, at least the people that I meet, a lot of people have a gender that they don't see fitting into, you know, the two discrete options presented. I'd say most of the people in my life, including my family, right? We're all complex people. So when I say that we as trans, like, are vulnerable to being robbed of the opportunities to participate in sport and compete in sport and know ourselves through competing in sport, I think it's really important for all of us who love sport and women's sport to, like, really put ourselves in the shoes of people who might not get to play. The stories we tell ourselves about ourselves are, for me, the most important thing about sport. And, you know, it was, that's another cool thing about working with Helen, was like looking at these experiences and being reminded that, yeah, this deserves academic publication. And so I talk about this one fight that I lost and how that's actually the most potent moment for me in my sport, in my sporting experience, was losing and getting back up after getting knocked down literally, like, really hard, really hard by the former Olympic champion.
Yeah. Well, you know, this brings me to the introduction of your book where you discuss the difference between inclusion and belonging. So, Helen, perhaps you could explain why belonging is more crucial for trans athletes than simply being included. And perhaps importantly, how can sports organizations foster a sense of true belonging?
Yeah. And as we used to say in a lot of other contexts, it's not enough for the dominant institution to say, the door is open, come on in. That doesn't make people feel welcome or belonging by simply having an open door and then saying, sort of just rolling your eyes and saying, well, we opened the door and they didn't come in, as though it's their fault, whoever the they are. And in this case, gender minoritized people who want to play sport. So the welcoming, in order to get the sense of belonging, involves a really careful scrutiny of a club's policies, programs, the rules of the game, the sort of extracurricular things that happen off the field or off the rink, out of the pool, who's included, who's not included, who feels that they are welcomed in with open arms and belong. And getting back to the question of how the stories have to be out there, just for the, probably when I started doing sociology of sport and particularly looking at gender issues, the image, if you asked the person in the street to name an athlete, you could be 99% sure they'd name a male athlete, a prominent male athlete. If you asked somebody, a child, let's say, to draw a picture of an athlete, would they draw a female athlete or a male athlete? Well, probably a male athlete. And not a whole lot has changed. So to have in the public imagination a range of athletic bodies that who, and all of these people with these bodies are all legitimate, genuine, dedicated athletes, regardless of their shape or size or whether they have long hair or short hair or lots of muscles or not many muscles or whatever. The public image of the sporting body can be enlarged significantly with non-binary and trans bodies being part of the landscape, part of the television coverage, without snide comments about their bodies, just as is. And depressingly, if we're thinking, as I might have been, that a lot of stuff has changed in the last 5 or 6 decades, and in the early days we were talking about sexploitation of female athletes and so on. And I just saw online today there's a lingerie company called Blue Bella, I think. I don't even want to repeat their name. They're so appalling and offensive. This lingerie company prides themselves on having partnerships and having female athletes pose in sort of garter belts and see-through bras and that sort of thing, and G-strings. This is progress, apparently, that it gives an image of sexy bodies so that, and the caption actually said something like 1/3 of girls drop out of sport when they reach their teen years, as if showing female athletes who are people in their own right, highly respected athletes in their own right. This was the rugby team from Team GB, Great Britain, or some of the young women who posed in this so-called lingerie. And they posed there ostensibly, or this is how they were exploited, basically, by this lingerie company, to give a sexy image of female athletes so that teenage girls wouldn't drop sport, which just is wrong on so many levels.
Well, I'm wondering, Ali, about your experience with boxing, when you felt, or if you did, when you felt you belonged rather than just being included.
That's a great question. It's hard because I think my coaches saw one way of doing things based on how they had done things. And really the question for me always was, as an athlete, not what should work, but what works is kind of the most challenging part of belonging for me in sport. And women's boxing was like a really awesome place to belong. You know, like it was the first time I saw a bunch of people who looked like me, who were like, you know, because when you're boxing, when anyone steps in the ring, you pace like a tiger. There's no, you know, we can say that's masculine. We can say it's feminine bodies doing it, whatever. Like it's you're consensually getting in the ring to like put down some other person or be put down. It is, it's not like a lot of other experiences in the world or in life, right? That most people in the world have. I don't know. Yeah, belonging felt good. Belonging felt really good. And it pushed me to become a better athlete.
Did you feel you had to prove yourself as an athlete to feel like you belonged?
Yeah. So I started boxing in 2012 when women's boxing was on the Olympics for the first time, or was in the Olympics for the first time, excuse me. And I went to the gym the next day after I watched Mary Spencer fight in the quarterfinals against the Chinese representative, and Mary lost. And so I was like, I can do it better than her. So I went to a boxing gym the next day and was like, I'm going to be your next Olympic champion. And that's like a really common thing in boxing gyms. But so they were like, yeah, sure, just keep coming back. Like, just try and don't miss practice. And I didn't miss practice. And by the end of that year, I was on the national team in boxing internationally. And, you know, when I had 5 fights, I fought Clarissa Shields, who's like, if you just look her up, she's one of the best boxers of all time. She's an Olympic champion more than once, more than twice, I think, professional champion. And I had 5 fights when I fought her. And so that's the experience I write about in my chapter. And I had to prove myself because they could tell that I was completely crazy. You know, like, I'm going to be an Olympic champion in 4 years. Nobody does that. You like, nobody pulls it off and nobody says they're going to do it if you have any sanity of you. And I was telling everybody who would listen, like, my plan to win, which is what I do. I'm very grandiose by nature, which has its benefits and its costs. But I didn't go to the Olympics in 2016. Our amazing athlete, Ariane Fortin, went. And I lost to her in the Olympic trials in the finals. And, you know, and then I got to cheer her on in Rio. And it was, there were some great fights. So she, in a way, she carried my Olympic dream, right? And represented Canada for it. So, yeah, I had to prove myself on the daily because everyone thought I was delusional and like, there's no way I was going to succeed. And then I did prove myself because I didn't do exactly what I said I was going to do, but
I followed my path to get there, you know, to the best of my ability. And I'm really happy with that.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, given the current landscape of controversies and debates surrounding trans inclusion in sports, what are some of the practical creative solutions or reimagined structures that could genuinely support and include trans and non-binary athletes?
I think some of these initiatives have been pioneered by LGB people before the LGBTQ community sort of developed more comprehensively. So there were community-based softball leagues, soccer leagues, swimming clubs that were buy-in for LGB people. They weren't excluding people who were not LGB, but the main purpose was to be a welcoming place and a place where LGB people could belong. And so I think those community-based initiatives, most of which have expanded to add trans people and any other LGBTQ and two-spirited in the case of Canada and so on, to be inclusive of all gender, sexual minorities, as well as the majority. So no one's excluded, everyone is included. And in my limited experience with the Not So Amazon Softball League in Toronto, which was a lesbian-focused softball league, purely recreational, not going up to any other level, no competitions against other leagues. It was all within one league, and there were probably a couple of hundred players at its kind of peak. And there were simple things like some of the rules were changed to accommodate the batter, people like me who'd never held a baseball bat or softball bat in our lives and never worn a glove. So ranging from total beginners like me to more competitive women who had played in competitive leagues, lesbians in competitive leagues that were whose members were mostly heterosexual and had felt, this was in the 80s, had been excluded, had not been allowed to take girlfriends to the banquets at the end of the season, or had done so but had been stigmatized because they had done that. So there was a need for lesbian leagues. And there have been some of the accounts I've read of trans athletes being welcomed, you know, literally welcomed and included in existing LGB leagues. One example, I think, was Terminal Frisbee, which they now call Frisbee Golf, where some of the American league, the national governing body for frisbee golf, no, disc golf, sorry, getting the terms wrong. They have specifically included trans players. So some of those grassroots initiatives, the leadership isn't going to come from an international federation, or almost never, or even a national sports organization. The initiative's going to come from the grassroots and hopefully sort of trickle upwards through to provincial and national levels, and maybe one day international.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. You can find more information about my guests on our website and a link to their book, Trans Athletes Resistance: The Struggle for Justice in Sport. I'd like to thank my guests for joining me today and the studio, This is Distorted.